You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show, rated the number one podcast of all time.
Of all time. Make sure you're ready, because this is the podcast where you are guaranteed to learn virtually everything.
You know, I don't do well in the cold. I know you've been hunting with Ranella, who knows more about hunting and animals than anybody I've ever met. It's the craziest thing.
Yeah, he knows his stuff.
Yeah. What did you guys go hunting for?
Caribou in Alaska.
Was it
speaking of the cold.
Dude, was it in the summer at least?
No, it was in the fall. It wasn't too chilly until it started to like hurricane gust while we were on the side of trying to sleep on the side of a lake.
That's a good time. Yeah, you know what you realize in those situations? What a city pussy you are. I don't know about you, but that's what I noticed.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, I had body warmers, and I did shoot two deer, though, I have to say. So,
hey, well done.
Yeah, real tough to do from 100 yards with a high-powered scoped rifle in a blind. God, I'm such a loser.
You just waited until the bear trap.
Exactly.
Stop its track.
I'm so glad to have you, because I probably recommend your book. The first thing I say to anybody, like Bill Burr, who was on this podcast recently, I don't know if you know Bill, but he's a great comic. And the first thing I say to anybody who wants to get in shape or learn about the body is I say you got to read The 4-Hour Body. I like that Hunter called me a little bit, texted me 3-4 days ago and said, dude, the 4-Hour Chef is amazing. He's talking about everything I talk about, deconstructing the learning process. I was like, yeah, no shit. That's why I talk about Tim Ferriss.
And he has a TV show that's debuting this Sunday.
Dude, you do?
Yeah, we're 8 episodes in, man. All that shit that we've been talking about when we meet up for dinner or drinks or whatever, it's... finally happened.
Wow.
Finally found the people to work with. So it's
what is it?
Well, it's the Tim Ferriss experiment, and each week I have to subject myself to some seemingly impossible task and try to deconstruct the learning process with the help of a world-class teacher. So that ranges from learning how to drum well enough, or attempting to learn how to drum well enough in 4 days to play a live concert with the rock band Foreigner to a sold-out crowd.
What? Dude, I've been taking drum lessons for 1 year. I'm so far away from that. If you do that in 4 days, I'm gonna have to on principle punch you in the face. I have to.
Or give that deer treatment that he was doling out in Wisconsin.
Yeah. Are you kidding me? 4 days? I'll freak out on you. Okay.
Yeah, it's up online right now. We put out the first episode for free everywhere, like Xbox, PlayStation, Amazon, YouTube, iTunes, everywhere.
Is that the drumming one?
That's the drumming one, so you can check it out.
Dude, I'm all over that. I'm all over it.
And it includes, you know, other stuff that ranges from like chess, Brazilian jiu-jitsu, to learning a language, to rally car racing, surfing, professional poker, all sorts of crazy shit. So that's the show. And the idea is, you know, each episode to give people a toolkit that they can use to replicate the results. So by the end of 13 episodes, they should have sort of all the principles they need to really double or triple their reading learning speed with any subject.
And the important thing is that because you're doing it across so many different skills, what you ultimately realize is that all learning works in the same way.
Exactly. Exactly right. Yep.
But let me ask you, because we had Dan Coyle on this podcast who wrote The Talent Code. I don't think it's a hit yet, but fascinating about, you know, I don't know if you read the book, Tim, but he went and studied all the talent hotspots and the teachers that the great teachers. Do you know the book?
I've heard of the book. I'm not familiar with the book.
Well, he went and looked at, you know, this tennis club in Russia that put out the top 20.
Sharapova, Kornikova.
Yeah, all these great tennis players. And it's one court, and it's a 77-year-old woman. And he went and found these essentially talent whisperers, these incredible coaches, and broke down the learning process. And they weren't inspirational speakers. They were just people concerned with information.
Also concerned with emotion. I mean, you know, Dan Coyle told this great, great story about this girl walks into the tennis club, and it's clearly her first day. She has her racket in a plastic bag, has no idea where she is, and the coach stops the practice and walks over to the girl and shakes her by the hand and says, "We're so glad to have you here. you know? And I mean, I think that's a large part of what's so important and so much of what comes out. You know, I had the privilege of listening to your last podcast with Tim, and so much of what comes out is just how important emotion is in the learning process. You know, you talk about, you know, people's intimidation, you know, what do they feel is a doable step that they can get on board with first, and then they can see the results, and then they can get more and more and more into it. I think so much of where we've gone wrong is that we've focused on the rational aspects of learning to the exclusion of the emotional aspects, and it really, the two go hand in hand.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more with that. I mean, because one thing I'm kind of fond of saying is that, you know, the best program is the program that you follow, which is why, for instance, I get a lot of flack for this. But if you look at, say, strict paleo and strict veganism on opposite ends of the spectrum, there, I won't argue that I think strict paleo is very effective for many different things, but it's also very, very inconvenient, and the adherence is poor. The abandonment rate is very high. So if I'm trying to impact, say, 1 million people most effectively and efficiently, I will start with a gateway behavioral change like the slow-carb diet, which is very easy to manage when you're traveling, very easy to manage on a low budget, and so on and so forth. And you start with that, and it relates a lot to the emotional. It relates a lot to the psychological. I mean, convenience, ease, avoiding intimidation, rather, providing people with early wins so that they can establish a habit before you really challenge them socially or otherwise. So yeah, totally agree.
Well, to piggyback on that, what I was saying is essentially, there is something called myelin, you know, which you develop, you know, the living circuit, you know, the fatty thing that kind of circuits are these circuits are organic, and you develop these biological circuits, but that also comes from a lot of practice. And I wonder, you know, it's one thing to deconstruct the learning process and learn a language in 3 months or 4 days or whatever it might be, but where do you come down on, how do you navigate, though, the bridge? I mean, there is something that one can't rush, and that is mastery at something over the long haul. You're never going to be a great stand-up unless you do it for a long time. I've never seen an exception to that. For that matter, you're never going to be a great tennis player, even if you have a great coach, without a lot of training. So how do you navigate sort of talk a little bit about the difference. When you say you deconstruct the learning process, you start people with small wins, you teach them proper technique, and what you try to do, Tim, is basically say, this is what you should focus on to really get good at something. And a lot of the other stuff people focus on is not as important. Isn't that what you're saying?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I can give you sort of an encapsulation of how I approach things. And also, I think it's, just to start off, really important that whenever you're discussing a potentially charged subject, like mastery, for instance, or let's take a really good example, God, right? So does God exist? Does God not exist? Well, let's make sure that we agree on a definition of God before we get into that fight, right? So I think that mastery is, whether the 10,000-hour rule applies or not, for instance, is predicated on defining the terms very carefully. Otherwise, the argument goes off the rails. So I would say that as it relates to, say, the 4-hour chef and even this TV show, potentially, like becoming world-class at something, in my mind, for what I discuss, is top 5% in the general population, right? So, and to give a real concrete example, let's just say, Brian, that we've talked about deadlifting before, right? So let's say you weigh, like, how much do you weigh, Brian?
170 pounds. I'm like a, think of a greyhound with feet.
But faster.
But faster, and a little more supple, not quite as tight and stiff.
With only a single horn on the forehead.
Thank you, sir. Thank you.
So, you're welcome. We got to get you on different supplements. But imagine you're 170 pounds. You go to a gym, any gym that you can think of, and you start deadlifting 500 pounds for reps. Okay, that is going to be at the very top of the general population, right? I mean, that is a very significant accomplishment. you would be sort of considered world class, meaning the world population top 5%.
Sure.
However, if you were to enter a high level powerlifting competition, you get laughed off the platform.
Right.
And so I distinguish very carefully between those two. And I think that when we look at
It's a great distinction, Tim. I mean, it's a great distinction. Yeah. As you say this, I just to interrupt you for a second. I love the distinction because I work pretty hard at my tennis game. It has nothing to do with winning matches or competing. There's something incredibly satisfying about getting good at something. And I guess the state you get yourself into when you're practicing properly and you're hitting the ball better than you ever thought you could do so. That becomes a personal.
And that state is called flow. I mean, Mihai Csikszentmihalyi has spent the last 30 years, 40 years studying that state.
100%.
And that's the point, is that is its own reward, you know?
And if you guys want to see something really amazing, I think it's just incredible. There's a book called, I believe it's just the Inner Game of Tennis.
Watch the video. I watched the video.
Okay,
you did. Thank you. I never forgot it. Watched it. It was brilliant, but keep going.
Isn't that amazing?
Yes.
So this video is old. I don't know what it is. It's like Betamax footage of
terrible TV footage.
TV show in the 70s, but you can find it on YouTube. The Inner Game of Tennis, where I believe it was, I want to say Galloway, is the teacher, who takes this woman who's in amazing, like, early 70s clothing.
Overweight,
sedentary, has never done athletics at all, and gets her to the point where she's playing a functional, competent tennis match with him in about 20 minutes.
Incredible. Serving well, hitting the ball, like respectable forehands. And maybe the first person in the history of tennis to use an open stance in her forehand, which is now standard practice. I was watching her going, well, she's hitting so naturally, and that's what tennis evolved into. You know, guys start saying, do we really have to turn our bodies? Maybe I can hit open it, because that's how I'd block a soccer ball, etc. That's how you box. And he said, just let your body, he uses the example of a child when they walk. You're not telling the child, look, keep your weight on your heel now, transfer to the ball of your foot now, careful not to, he's mimicking. He's just doing, he's watching,
And so I think that illustrates how quickly you can get to a functional level. Then from that point, let's just say the next is getting to a performance level, like performing in a rock concert. And then at that point, if you want to get to the mastery level, there are many different ways to measure that, right? But let's just say one of the benchmarks would be top 1% in the general population. And then I do think there is a point where genetic sort of determinism comes in a bit. And I mean, I would love to hear both your thoughts on this. But if you look at, say, competitive swimming, as you move through, say, a high-level high school competition, you see many different body types. Then you get into college Division I competition. They start to blend together and look more similar, and then you get to, say, the finals in the Olympics, and they all have a rather bat-like appearance and look like Michael Phelps.
Yeah. Michael Phelps, you look like a bat.
Long torso, short legs.
Yeah.
Yeah, we had a guy, David Epstein, on our podcast.
Who's a writer for Sports Illustrated.
And wrote The Sports Gene.
It's an awesome, awesome, awesome book. But the point he makes is that, you know, yes, there are a lot of weird genetic things going on among Olympians. For example, there essentially people who are intersex are overrepresented in female athletics. A lot of them turn out to be not totally female. And so, you know, I mean, that's why they have, you know, different limb ratios and all sorts of things like that.
Yeah, you're not going to be sprinting in the finals of the Olympics or World Championships, sorry, unless you're of West African origin and probably somewhere in the Biafra coast. If you could find me one example in 25 years, please do. You can't. So.
But the interesting thing is that David Epstein does provide two contrasting examples of the Swedish high jumper who trained obsessively for 20 years and, you know, won the Olympic gold medal. And then on the other hand, you have this guy who, you know, tries high jumping as a joke and, you know,
wins the world championship.
So, I mean, you know, it's interesting because, yes, you know, huge amounts of practice and of the right kind of practice can make up for those natural physical differences. I think the bigger thing is that we make the mistake of thinking that athletics are the same as academics. And the analogy doesn't necessarily work, and that analogy is incredibly misleading in general. I mean, in 2010, Nature Neuroscience published a review of what we know about the genetics of intelligence. And they concluded that while we'd found 300 genes for mental retardation, conditions like Down syndrome and things like that, things that are very well established, we'd found zero genes for normal to above average intelligence. So the analogy doesn't necessarily work, and there are a lot of things about that physical thinking that learning mentally is the same as learning physically or physical limits is misleading. For example, we often talk about, you know, how students need to sweat, right? You know, it's hard work. Brian has a story about how he was told to focus, and he thought that meant squint. But so a lot of what we think of with athletics, when we then apply it to academics, it leads to the totally wrong lesson because, of course, so much of what being able to perform really quickly and get to that first level of competence is about being relaxed, you know?
Yep.
And so,
and just believing you can do it.
Yeah.
And I think those go hand in hand. Sorry, I jumped in. Feel free.
No, it's okay. I was gonna plug Hunter's book to you. You should read The Straight A Conspiracy, because he wrote a book called with Katie O'Brien, and it's essentially about this. About your book, you should read it. He wrote it for high school students, but it's a great book and relevant to everybody. And I think it's. I'm glad I got you guys together to talk because it's right up your alley. It is about the learning process. Hunter spends a lot of time tutoring. And educating. And so he kind of realized that there was a great deal of shame attached to learning.
Well, that's the central problem. I mean, you know, you've hit it on the head, Tim. It's believing you can do it. And, you know, what the experience we had is, you know, we would work with students and we would hear them say things like, I didn't get the math gene, I don't have a natural ear for languages, I'm just not a writer. And, you know, it took us a long time to figure it out. We had to do a lot of research, a lot of working with students, a lot of asking them about their experience. But what it really comes down to is there's a reason why we say feel stupid. And that's because stupid is a feeling. And specifically, it's the feeling of shame. And what shame causes you to do is avoid the source of your shame, which in the context of learning is your mistakes. But of course, your mistakes are the basis of getting better. And so these students feel terrible about themselves in school, and they never get better because they're constantly taking their tests and wadding them up and putting them in the bottom of their backpack. And the answer is to do all of the stuff that you talk about in the meta-learning section, which is so simple. You get out the parts that aren't working in your process, the things that are going the worst, and you analyze them and figure out what's going wrong and use that to improve, which, by the way, is deliberate practice, which is what Anders Ericsson, the guy from the 10,000-hour rules, talks about. That's expertise. You look at your mistakes.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more. And I think that, you know, on top of that, it's very helpful, I think, as a practice to teach students, whether it's in school or in life, in adulthood, to ask better questions. Mm-hmm. In other words, I didn't learn to swim until after age 30, and it was always one of my biggest embarrassments. I was humiliated, and I grew up on Long Island, right by the water, for God's sake, and I had this acute fear and shame associated with this. And the only way that I learned to swim, there were a few things that happened. And of course, this is related to the framework in the 4-hour chef, which is just in quick review for people who aren't familiar with it. You have, you know, deconstruction, so breaking down, say, learn Spanish into smaller Lego blocks that are easier to tackle. Then selection, which is choosing the 20% that get you 80% of what you need. Let's just say that the highest frequency vocabulary items, so that you don't think of learning the language as taking a lifetime, which is nonsense, but rather 1,500 words that you can learn over, say, a few weeks. And then sequencing, putting them in the right order. And the last one is why I bring this up, stakes. So creating some type of incentive that is either a reward or a punishment that actually compels you to practice the way that you've set out. So in the case of swimming, I have a friend, and the two of us assign each other New Year's resolutions because we realize that setting New Year's resolutions doesn't really work. Mm-hmm. And so each year,
and it doesn't work because you always pick the thing that you know you are comfortable doing rather than the thing you need to do.
Yeah, or the thing that's just difficult enough that if you're not accountable to someone else, you won't do it.
Yeah.
And so he assigned me a 1 kilometer open water race by the end of the year. This is 2008.
Wow.
And I couldn't swim, you know, 3 laps in a pool.
That's not easy. A 1 kilometer swim in open water sucks.
Yeah, not easy. And so I assigned him, because he was drinking like 6 to 10 triple espressos a day. I was like, all right, you can't have any stimulant stronger than green tea. No more coffee, no more espresso for a year. And he was like, done. So we both agreed to this, and I got towards the end of 2008. I tried so many classes, and they were all teaching swimming the same way. They're like, okay, this is how I was taught. This is how I'm going to teach you. Here's a kickboard. Go warm up. And literally, my feet were like butter knives. I don't know what's wrong with my anatomy, but like, I don't move on a kickboard.
Well, you're not shaped like a bat. That's the problem.
Yeah, it's so embarrassing. I wouldn't even move. And I'd get like halfway across my first lap, and I'd just be spent, and I'd quit. And then if I tried to breathe, I would panic if they actually tried to teach me how to swim, so on and so forth. So I tried and tried and tried to find a coach, and I quit repeatedly. And then everything changed when a buddy of mine, who's not built for swimming but finished his first Ironman, said, all right, you need to check out total immersion swimming. And total immersion teaches you to question all the fundamental assumptions of swimming. So do you need to learn to swim do you need to kick a lot when you learn to swim? Do you need to practice breathing when you learn to swim? And by asking these seemingly absurd questions, and asking, for instance, like, what if I had to learn to swim without kicking and without learning to breathe, to avoid those failure points in the first, say, 5 sessions, so you can establish a habit? And the answer is yes. You can go into a lane where the water is 4 feet deep and practice just kicking off the wall and nailing the hydrodynamics of swimming, and then you stand up. You don't have to swim. You're not kicking. Mm. And you do that for your first day or two of practice. And by having this logical progression, I literally went from, you know, probably two or three laps maximum to about 40 laps per practice session in 10 days. It was all technique.
Yeah.
And ended up by the end of the year, swimming not just a kilometer, but like a mile open water in the ocean.
Yeah. Wow.
And like totally changed my life. And the way we got there, though, is by asking these really crazy questions. And I think that that's very, very useful, right? Like, if you're afraid of, say, whatever, grammar tables, okay, well, can you learn a language without ever looking at a grammar table? Or could you learn a language without ever even doing written exercises? And the answer is, of course, yes. And you can find a teacher like Michelle Thomas, M-I-C-H-E-L. Mm-hmm.
By the way, another recommendation that I've gone through all 7 CDs. Thank you very much.
Now
I got to work on my vocabulary. Who's my next tutor in this?
Well, Michelle Thomas has a vocabulary builder too.
Does he?
Yeah, yeah. There's a whole series. There's an advanced, and then there's vocabulary builder.
All right.
Suggest for the vocab going to vized.com. I like analog. You can find apps for this as well, but I really enjoy analog.
Which, by the way, after listening to your last episode with Brian, I ordered $250 worth of VizEd flashcards this afternoon. So, yeah, another great recommendation.
Wait,
from Tim Ferriss.
It only cost you $250.
Well, but to be fair, I ordered them for about a dozen languages. So, you know, that's why they're not that expensive.
Hunter has a working knowledge and a very real one of about 9 languages. What did you study at Harvard? You were a biochem,
yeah.
He was a biochem major at Harvard and decided, I'm going to learn 9 languages.
Well, no, I finished up. I finished all my requirements in the first 3 years because I was like, I didn't know what I wanted to do in college. I'd spent a year working in a lab and I was like, well, I guess I'll just major in biochem. Why not? Finished all my requirements. And then the last year, all I did was languages. That was the best senior year ever.
That's good, because I was a B student from American University in history. But Tim, I want to piggyback on this for a second, because one of the things that people don't talk about is the ability. You know, you're also, it's one thing to sort of do these things and deconstruct the learning process. It's another to find a really good tutor. It's another to find the source. And I know you can Google things, but talk a little bit about how you, because you're very good at finding your gurus, finding the source.
But why do you think he's so good at finding those gurus?
Because he is a guru.
Because he understands the learning process. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
you know, in order to be a smart shopper, you have to know what you're shopping for.
Right.
And that's, I think that's so much of what it is that, you know, Tim has spent all of these years figuring out how the learning process works. And so he's able to spot, you know, what is really going to work and what's really not going to work.
Yeah. Is that true, Tim? Talk a little bit about that.
I think that's definitely part of it. But I actually just pulled up the questions that I used to find teachers. So I can read these questions to you. The first thing I'll typically do is try to identify someone who is just the best at what they do, or even better, the person who was the best in the world, say, 5 or 10 years ago. Because the people who are best now are in the limelight or in demand, and they're hard to get responses from.
Mm-hmm. Like Brian Callen, for example, in the world of comedy.
Well, and having the number one podcast of all time.
That's right.
According to the International Podcast of All Time magazine. but keep going with your questions.
Precisely. So I reached out to this. I mean, of course, I have a slight advantage here, but I did this well before I wrote any of these books. I reached out to a guy named Scott Jurek, who's an incredible ultra marathoner. He won a race called the Western States 100, which is a mountainous 100-mile race.
God, that's so ridiculous. Jeez.
He won that high altitude 7 times in a row. All right.
I wonder what his VO max is.
Yeah, yeah, it's more than all of the oxygen that I breathed today, probably. So where I was going with this is, you know, Scott Jurek is built like Jack from The Nightmare Before Christmas. I mean, he's perfect for ultra-endurance running. So I can learn a lot from Scott, but he has attributes that I cannot develop, and I need to focus on technique, mm-hmm. all right, which are very important to separate. So the questions I asked him were the following. Who is good at ultra running despite being poorly built for it? Who's good at this who shouldn't be? Okay, that was number one. Mm-hmm. Number two, who are the most controversial or unorthodox runners or trainers? Why? What do you think of them? The next question is really important. Who are the most impressive? Like, to you, who are the most impressive teachers who are lesser known, right? So, like, kind of the dark horse teachers are really amazing, but very few people know about them. Then there are others, questions like directly to Scott, what makes you different? Who trained you or influenced you? Have you trained others to do this? Have they replicated your results? That's a really critical question.
Yep.
Again, to separate out the attributes from technique. What are the biggest mistakes and myths you see in ultra running training? What are the biggest wastes of time? And then these are more related to helping me self-study than teacher selection, but there are only two left, so I'll mention them. What are your favorite instructional books or resources on the subject? If people had to teach themselves, could not find a teacher, what would you suggest they use? And then the last one is kind of the money shot, which is, if you were to train me for 4 weeks, for a blank, right? If you were to train me for 4 weeks for an ultra running competition, say it's a 50-mile race or 50-kilometer race, and you had $1 million on the line, what would the training look like?
I love that question.
And of course, typically they'll say, well, it's impossible. I'm like, but I understand it's impossible, but like, if you had $1 million on the line and like I took your, you know, mom hostage, like, what would you do? Right? Had to try
Let's jack up the ante here. I got your mom hostage and you get $1 million and your mom back.
That's all right. I got your mom. What do you think now? Huh?
Yeah.
But so those are the type of questions I ask. And this is just, it's a template that anyone can use. I'll give you, and then I have a separate set of questions.
I got to tell you, and I want to hear the separate set of questions, but it's very interesting to me because I my buddy was GSP's training partner for many, many years, Brendan Schaub, who's now a heavyweight contender. And then there's a coach in Dan Quayle's book who coached and worked with Connors and Federer and all those guys. And he said, Federer and Connors basically practice about an hour a day on their stroke. They don't practice more than that. Oh, and by the way, GSP says more than an hour of practice on one thing, like you're striking or you start to lose focus and you start to. So there's that concept that Dan Quayle calls deep practice, which really means working on what, you know, working, pinpointing and being surgical about your practice.
Working on what's not working.
Working on what's not working.
Yeah, well, let me add to that just because this is very recent for me. So I did rally car racing for, you know, the Tim Ferriss Experiment, the show that I'm filming. And we had, I think, basically 3.5 days to try to learn enough to go out on a real rally course and compete in a race, which is really, really dangerous. The coach, a guy named Tim O'Neill, is like a 5-time national and North American rally champion. And like, you name the rally racer, you know, like Ken Block, Pastrana, it doesn't matter. They've all been like Dave Mirra. They've all been taught by him. He's just the Yoda of that world. And he emphasized multiple times that it is counterproductive to have too much ass and seat time. He's like, it is a big mistake to practice too much. Mm-hmm. And he would deliberately try to stop us at, you know, 3 o'clock, and he'd be like, we're done, because that's when you get sloppy, when you get fatigued, that's when you make mistakes, that's when you not only reinforce mistakes, that's when you get injured.
Wow.
And so, and this is so, it's so fun for me to show people these patterns, you know what I mean? Like, it's not just Federer, it's not just this guy or that guy or GSP or Tim O'Neill, like, the best in the world are not necessarily putting in 20 hours a day.
Which is very new to me, too. I always thought...
Yeah, but it's new to everybody.
Yeah, it's new to everybody. I mean, I always thought if you want to write a book, you got to write 10 hours a day.
That's the model of intelligence that we've been raised on. We've been raised on the idea that some people are naturally gifted and that if you want to succeed, you have to throw all of your time at it. But that's really not what it's about. I mean, the point is that it's the natural flexibility of every human brain that makes greatness possible for all of us. And it's about quality of practice. It's not about quantity of practice.
Mm. Yeah, I wanted to, this is of course it related, but slightly separate. So the myelination, you mentioned myelin. I do think that obviously, as was mentioned earlier, there are a lot of differences between sports and academics. However, I also think that the sort of artificial separation of mind and body can be very counterproductive in some respects, meaning using exercise and sports to accelerate learning, I think, is a very real phenomenon. And there's been some really fascinating research done. I think it's out of the University of Minnesota. There are other scientists doing this type of work. But looking at how even... and I'm not exaggerating, it's like 5 to 10 minutes of exercise, whether it's like high intensity interval training or even moderate cycling, can increase something called brain-derived neurotrophic factor.
Yep.
And improve neuroplasticity and accelerate, for instance, very, very specifically, foreign language vocabulary acquisition. So it's really cool to see the interplay of the physical and the mental, and how you can really use a very, very simple prescription, like basic physical activity for 5 to 10 minutes, to help students who are otherwise struggling and just give them an extra leg up. And that's detailed at length in a book called Spark.
By John Rady, which is an awesome, awesome book.
Yep, correct.
Yeah, so in other words, you get them to do something physical, even though what they're practicing is mental. Say if they're working on a math problem or something, you would get them to do something physical because that would stimulate something else in the brain.
Well, the classic example is he goes and visits the school that has instituted what's, you know, zero period. And what they do is they make the kids just run around a lot. It's exercise. Not only does it help, BDNF helps myelination and all of that sort of stuff and nerve growth, it also is about the most effective antidote to ADHD you can find.
Well, that's for sure with me. Yeah. I write when I'm walking. You know, Tim, it's too bad you saw my hour when I was literally starting a whole new hour. You got to see it now. I'm about to shoot my special. So when I'm in DC, I promise I'll make you laugh. I write that way. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, I was just going to say, I love nothing more than to see someone working on their material, just because I know that's such... Do you follow me? Like, I would love to see the polished stuff, but man, I find it so fascinating to see someone working through their material. And because we're all human, and it's not like you just walk out and ace the thing. There are many examples of this. I mean, you can watch like the documentary, I guess it's The Comedian, where you just see Seinfeld, like bombing and forgetting his lines and fucking up. And it applies to so many areas.
Jiro Dreams of Sushi is another great one. I mean, it's just so, so much fun to just see people in that state of flow and totally engaged and trying to reach mastery.
Yeah. I took us into the exercise realm, but...
Listen, you're absolutely right. I mean, you know, we're all paying for Descartes. I mean, you know, the guy hundreds of years ago says that the mind and the body are separate, and it has messed up so many aspects of life, and it's important that we realize that, you know, as the Romans said, mens sana in corpore sano, healthy mind and a healthy body.
This podcast is intellectual. Fuck! Holy shit, we're not playing around, you guys.
But the other thing that I think is really important to notice,
I don't know if that's Latin, but I could be like, well, as websites that haven't had text put on them yet say, it's in Delorum, blah, blah, blah.
You are correct, sir.
I think the other thing that's really important to note about what Tim's doing and why it's so effective is that he's asking questions, you know, so much. I mean, you know, the National Academy of Sciences, and this things that drive me nuts. They wrote this document. They took all of the research and they consolidated it into a single document, which is about 700 pages long. And after you read all 700 pages, at the very, very end of the document, they say, everything that we have said in this document can be summed up in one word. And you're like, why didn't you say that in the intro?
Yeah.
But the one word is metacognition, which is thinking about thinking. And that's what Tim does. That's what meta-learning is.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's the difference between effective students and ineffective students. Effective students think about their own thinking. They think about their process and are constantly trying to improve it.
It's kind of like I read that famous story of the famous Rabbi Hillel, who, you know, all these rabbis were studying the Torah and they dedicate their whole life. And he basically said, the Torah can be summed up in the following sentence: that which is hateful to you, don't do to others.
Yeah.
And class over.
Bam.
You know. So. But that's the whole point. I think you're very valuable, Tim. I think, and, you know, Hunter, your book. And I like showcasing this stuff because I run into so many people who essentially say things like, well, I'm never going to be able to do this because I don't have the time or what have you. And I think we do. We have a warped sense of what it means to accomplish something and certainly what it means to enjoy getting really good at something. It's either all or nothing, especially in this culture. There's something about that that has to be kind of tackled.
It has to be fixed, because that's the point is that we all lose. Like the society that we have, when everybody is fulfilling their potential and where everybody is in that state of flow and where everybody's on a quest to achieve something, that's an amazing society to live in, and that's a society that we all deserve.
Jesus.
Yeah, and I think I was just gonna add to that you know, what I'm trying to do, whether it's through the books or the TV show, is to demonstrate that learning something and getting pretty fucking good at it, not necessarily becoming Yo-Yo Ma or Tiger Woods, but like getting to a level where you can like respectably perform a new skill and have fun doing it, does not have to be complicated at all. Like, it can be so almost ridiculously simplistic in terms of the approach. Like, you watch this video related to the inner game of tennis. Like, nothing could look more simple, where he's like, okay, I'm going to teach you to serve. I'm not even going to describe the technique. Just go bum, 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 and like has her repeat this rhythm that ingrains the right tempo, and then boom, she's hitting serves.
You know, but a lot of that is, from what I got from the inner game of tennis, and a lot of learning in many ways, not to be too zen about it, is getting out of the way, getting out of your own way.
Well, that's
I do with stand up the other day. I hate to talk about this on the air, but I'm making a point. You know, I was in Sacramento and I realized I've been doing it so long now. And you know, you get to a point with when you're doing your stand up where I guess what happens is, you know, the experience becomes something you're so in control of. and it's working on an audience so effectively that in some ways you feel like you're letting air in and out of a balloon. You're playing the audience as though they were an instrument. It no longer becomes about your act because you're feeling your act. You don't have to prepare anything. You just get up and you just go and see what's in front of you. And you react to whatever the audience might be and whatever they look like and whatever they sound like and the temperature in the room. And you're able to chunk all this information. And what happens is, after a while, this very surreal experience of kind of feeling as though you're managing their energy. You don't want to kill them with too many laughs in the beginning because then they'll be tired at minute 60. It's a really wonderful place to get to, in a sense. You kind of feel, I swear to God, I feel like the audience was sort of my accordion or my balloon I was blowing air into and out of. It was a very surreal experience. And I don't mean to sound like I'm this great fucking comedy genius. I don't mean it that way. A lot of comics would agree with what I'm saying if they've been doing it as long as I have.
But in terms of the patterns that Tim is pointing out, a lot of expert performers in any field would agree.
Yeah.
You know, this is something that is universal and human.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
That's right. But I'm kind of jumping on over what you had said, which is the idea that you can really enjoy something and really get pretty damn functionally good at something with not a whole lot of effort, just knowing where to place your energy. And that's kind of what you contribute.
Yeah, no, the teaching is even more fun than learning for me. And I always thought I was going to be a 9th or 10th grade teacher just because I had some really key influences that sort of sent me in one direction around that age, where a lot of my friends went the other direction and overdosed on drugs and stuff. But the fact of the matter is, like, you can take someone who is deathly afraid of swimming, right? Like, immediately panics when they're set in water deeper than their height, and get them to the point where they have really impressive technique and swim 4 laps in an Olympic-sized pool in a couple of days. And, like, that is a life changer.
It's a life changer. They do that with people who have who are chronically shy, like terribly shy. People who can't speak to somebody of the opposite sex, for example. And they'll just basically, there's a step-by-step process to get them over that stuff.
Yeah. And the experience, I just want to put a little sort of button on the swimming, which is the feeling that they have when they do that for the first time is, I think, every bit as, like, magical as the experience you mentioned on stage after putting in your 10,000 hours in comedy. They're not the same, but in terms of the reward that you get and the bug that bites you, mm-hmm. I think it's every bit as sort of magnificent. And it doesn't take that long. I mean, mm-hmm. that's when you start to realize, like, there's so many old wives' tales where people are told if things are repeated so often that they're thought to be true, like, oh, it takes a lifetime to learn a language. That's total horseshit. And if you buy into that, you never start anything. Whereas if you can demonstrate, like, dude, if you want to learn a language a year, easy. No problem. Like, think about what your life is going to look like if you could do that. Or if you could learn a different instrument every year well enough to do A, B, C, D, or E. Or, like, a different sport every year well enough to do D, E, and F. It's like, holy crap. Like, your entire view of reality changes. It's like, if your life is how much experience you can cram into these years, you just, like, doubled or tripled your lifespan, basically.
What is your favorite thing to do, Tim? You do so many things, but what do you think is, I mean, you know, you write books, you roll, you do a lot of jujitsu, you're playing the drums, and you're doing all. Have you come across anything that you want to just keep doing all the time?
this is not a dodge at all. I think that what I most enjoy doing is studying this meta learning stuff. So it's like having those epiphanies about new skills is what I enjoy. I'd be like, oh my God, like. One of the episodes, oh my God, Brian, you'd love this one. So I did a combination of Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu and chess in one episode.
The Josh Waitzkin episode?
Yeah, was it with Josh Waitzkin?
That is the Josh Waitzkin episode.
Because I love his book. I mean, that's what he talks about. Yeah.
So it's Josh Waitzkin and Marcelo Garcia.
Oh, the master.
So this episode will blow your mind, but the we're taking chess principles and applying them to learning jujitsu. So like beginning, like starting with the end game, right? Like so you're not learning openings first. You're learning the end game. So you have like pawn and king versus king, and like, okay, how do you mimic that in jujitsu, and how do you use opposition and all these?
I fucking love that, dude. why didn't I think of this TV show? I'm so happy for you, though. It sounds fat. What is the network? What's it on?
The network is HLN. So it used to be CNN Headline News. It's now HLN. It's on Turner. And
dude, it's an important show. We gotta really pump this show. That's an important show. That sounds fantastic, man.
I'm super stoked. And dude, the jujitsu. I'm not going to give away too much, but I'll tell you. So I got destroyed by the parkour episode, just like completely destroyed myself. And then I haven't done jits in fucking years.
I walk out there.
And it's like these monsters who've been trained by Marcelo. And gotcha. I get choked. I think it was Josh is like, dude, your lips are purple. Why don't you sit down? And then got like this dude hit a double leg takedown on me. And this is like a 190-pound Brazilian monster
who
no-gi worlds. And landed with all of his weight on his shoulder right in my ribs. And I just heard like popping sounds.
Oh.
And it wasn't a fracture. I got x-rays, but it was like torn cartilage between the ribs. So it felt like a fracture.
Never.
And that was the
takes
first,
a long time
first,
to heal. Yeah.
The first morning of the entire week.
Oh, God.
Oh, my God.
I mean, talk about being thrown to the lions.
oh, my God. You'll love this episode because it's got the jiu-jitsu and a lot of just absurd footage of jiu-jitsu, but also has speed chess. And, oh, my God. It was so much fun.
Dude, that's so incredible.
That's great.
I can't wait to watch the show. And who is your drum teacher?
Oh, the drumming teacher. I had two teachers. The best known is Stuart Copeland, so the founding member.
Oh my
of the
God! Piece. Kiss my ass. I want that guy.
One of the top 10 drummers of all time. Pretty widely considered. Hilarious guy. He's a lot like Doc from Back to the Future. Just so absurdly good. So yeah, this is.
And who was the other teacher?
The other teacher was actually a lesser-known guy. His name is Adam Timmerman, and he is one of the head drum instructors at School of Rock. And it was great to have him involved because Stuart is an incredible drummer, also a very good teacher, but he doesn't teach as his profession at all.
Yeah.
And
I mean, sometimes when you get a genius like that or a guy who's that good and been doing it so long, it's hard for him to start from the beginning, isn't it? I mean,
yeah, oh, absolutely. And I think that's true for everybody, right? It's like if somebody walked up to you and they were like, Brian, please teach me English. You'd be like,
Right, right.
Well,
depends on what she looked like, but I know what you mean. Yeah.
Yeah.
We'd start with a lot of relaxation exercises. You know, those pants are way too restrictive. You got to
open up so the diaphragm can really breathe and you can articulate.
That's it. There it is. Sorry, Tim. This is an important.
No. Sorry. I spilled the reverie drifting off.
Exactly.
The balance of having both of those teachers was really, really phenomenal. And that was the same, say, you know, Marcelo and Josh, right? You have two sets of eyes on the same puzzle, which is extremely helpful. That's also why, when possible, I actually don't prefer one-on-one lessons. I'd much prefer to have another student at around my level as a participant, so I can observe mistakes and see what's getting corrected. I mean, think about jiu-jitsu as an example. It's like, how can you see what the hell is happening when someone's demonstrating on you or vice versa? It's really hard.
It's interesting you say that because in the Spartak Tennis Club that put out these top 20 women tennis players and they had resounding success, not just women, men as well. She was responsible for the Russian Revolution in tennis where all of a sudden Sharapova comes along and now, you know, that there are 20, 30, 40 women playing at the top level. And she only teaches group classes. She does not teach one-on-ones. They have one court and they spend a lot of time not even hitting a ball. So there it is.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, I need to read this book. I've been getting really into tennis. Side note, I don't even know the first thing about it, just because I read Andre Agassi's autobiography. It's
great
amazing.
Book. A great book. That's a great book. Open. Yeah.
Love that. Oh, man.
Yeah.
So good.
Well, and that's the thing is, I mean, you know, you mentioned this in the last podcast, I think, about how, you know, there was some 14-year-old Wimbledon phenom, and then she tried to write about, you know, what it was that
well,
she
that's,
did.
Well, that's David Foster Wallace's book, How Tracy Austin Broke My Heart.
Yeah.
Because a physical genius a lot of times has a lot of trouble putting into words how they do what they do, because so much of it is a feeling. But more importantly, when what they find is, like, you know, when they ask athletes, like, what was it like to win the Super Bowl? And they'd always say something really sort of glib, you know, or mundane, sort of like, well, you know, we just try to get the football down the field, and that's our job. Well, that's actually important for top athletes to not be overthinkers, and certainly not be too poetic or nuanced about the thought process.
Are you ready to tie some things together, Brian?
Yeah, they'll get in their own way. So, yes.
Are you ready to tie some things together?
Yes.
So why is it that Tim is able to learn these skills, you know, and get to a good level of proficiency in about 4 hours? Why is it that you're talking about things being zen? Because essentially most of what people are dealing with in the early stages where they're failing is intrusive thoughts. And those intrusive thoughts fill up their attention and make their attention unavailable for engaging with that task. And that's really what being zen or being in the moment or anything like that is about. It's having your attention completely free.
And that's what you're here for, to tie things together.
Together in a little bow.
Tim, take it away.
And scene.
Yeah. Well, we do have a little soundboard here. We could do some clapping studio.
Yeah, yeah.
You know.
I'm really looking forward to seeing to seeing the drumming episode, though, to see how these two guys help you. I mean, I can't believe, did they really get you ready for a concert?
Yeah, man, you'll have to check it out.
I mean, yeah, exactly. No spoilers.
I do have my moments, my dark hours.
Oh my God.
But it's all there. Yeah, you can. I mean, just go to iTunes and you'll see it. Smack dab, Tim Ferriss Experiment. But I'm trying very, very hard to create a show that is accurate and actionable, and obviously it has to be entertaining. So I think it's getting there. I mean, I think it's really getting there. So that you know, the whole DIS framework from the 4-Hour Chef, like, it's right in there for the 80-20 analysis. It's right in there, like, talking about how you apply that to music. And I'll keep my fingers crossed, but I don't know, man. I think it's kind of working.
So I look, man, it sounds fantastic, and I know enough about you. I've watched your TED lectures. I've read all your books, and you know, I can't see it not being really, really interesting and entertaining. I mean, there's no way. So when you get my seal of approval, my friend, that's worth at least 20, 30 viewers.
Put a sticker on the front of a novel. Like,
exactly.
Those and stick them on the thumbnail on iTunes. It'd be amazing.
Correct. By the way, Joe Rogan says hi. I was with him, as you know, this whole weekend. So he says,
oh, awesome.
Yeah, you got to. I'll let him know about your show too. So
yeah, that'd be awesome.
Yeah.
Well, guys, this has been really fun. I mean, this is obviously a topic I just do not get tired of.
Dude, let me know when you're in LA so we can grab a meal and let's play some tennis. You should see what I look like in a pair of shorts. I'm like a cat.
Or a UPS driver.
Yeah.
See you in some nice Euro 70s style shorts.
That's what I'm talking about, my friend. In a straight way, obviously.
Yeah.
But, you know.
And very tightly cropped.
Hey, have a happy Thanksgiving, man. I think you're with your family in New York, right?
I am. Yep.
All right, buddy. Well done. One last question: is there a book on the horizon, or are you just focusing mostly on this TV show, the Tim Ferriss Experience?
I am 100% focused on the Tim Ferriss Experiment. The entire show itself is an experiment, right? So you kind of get to see us trying different formats and approaches as well in each episode, which is kind of fun. I mean, very meta, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And people should know The 4-Hour Body. I talk about it a lot, but I love the book because you put yourself, you not only talk to all the experts in the world about everything from muscle growth to how to lose weight to optimize your energy to from the vegan diet to the paleo diet, but you experiment on yourself, man. You use yourself as a complete guinea pig. You get your genome tested and everything. So, you know.
Yeah, it's fun. You know, I've had a couple of new milestones in reader case studies in the last few months too. I've had more than a few people who've lost each more than 200 pounds, which is pretty wild.
That's awesome.
Wow. How do you eat typically, Tim? Do you still do the one day where you go crazy and boost your glycogen levels
fatter
by eating?
Fatter day.
Yeah, eat crazy shit like 20
Saturday.
Donuts.
Yep. I still do Saturday. Still do cheat day.
Nice.
But I've shifted my cheat day a little bit. Used to be always on Saturdays. And I realized, oops, if you're filming Monday morning, you still look like a fat bastard and a fucking Michigan man if you do your cheat day all the way up until you go to bed on Saturday. So I've shifted it back to like the last half of Friday is kind of my cheat day these days.
There you go, brother. Well, that's because you're a TV star now. So you got to be aware. I got to be aware of that chiseled face, those chiseled features. My brother, have a happy Thanksgiving. Thank you so much for doing the podcast, man. I'm glad you met Hunter, too.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, man. This is great to have a little cognitive threesome.
Exactly.
A mutual appreciation club.
Yeah, you got a standing invite, and when you come to LA, dinner on us. Some good wine.
Awesome, man. Yeah, look forward to hanging more, guys. Have a wonderful Thanksgiving.
Thanks, Tim.
Tim Ferriss. Okay.
All right, bye, guys.
Bye.
That's great.
Yeah. I think the other interesting thing, too, is, you know, now that there are three books in the 4-hour series, I mean, you can really start with any of them. And I mean, that's the thing. Obviously, you resonate so much with the 4-hour body. I resonate with the 4-hour chef.
I love the 4-hour chef, though, because it's all about what we talk about.
Yeah. But I think that's the thing is, you know, for people out there, I mean, you know, see which one appeals to you most. Start with that. Because I read the 4-hour work week first, and I don't think I was in a position to appreciate it. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, now I actually want to cycle back to it and reread it.
Yeah.
Now understanding more of where he's coming from.
It's good stuff, man. Yeah. I reread Dan Coyle's book, who we're going to have on the podcast very soon, The Talent Code.
Yeah.
I love that book, man.
Yeah, it's an incredible book.
Another book that Hunter Motz has exposed me to. But, you got anything else you want to say, my friend?
Well, we're actually going to have talent Dan Coyle on again with Dave Epstein.
Oh, I can't wait.
Yeah.
I can't wait.
Where we're going to basically dispel nature versus nurture and say nature and nurture.
And by the way, there's a rumor we might have Jared Diamond, Pulitzer Prize-winning author of Guns, Germs, and Steel, a seminal work.
Yeah, probably the book that has most changed my life. I mean, that book utterly revolutionized my experience of life.
Yeah, like, would you say that's the first book to start with when you want to learn about history? And
absolutely, without a freaking doubt. Like, that book, I mean, you know, talk about, I felt like Saul on the road to Damascus. The scales fell from my eyes.
Who then became Paul. If you're reading the Greek translation versus the Roman, I think. I don't know how it works, the Latin.
Yeah. But I mean, you know, such an important book. And I think, you know, the reason why I wanted to get Charles Mann on and the reason why I want to get Jared Diamond on is because essentially together those books destroy the idea of race. And I think that's so much of, you know, people try and solve racism by saying that in spite of our belief in race, we should all get along. But I think what, you know, those two books do is they destroy the idea of race at all. Mm-hmm. And once you get rid of the idea of race, which from a biological standpoint is utterly ridiculous, mm-hmm. you know. Once,
certainly intellectually.
It's utter.
Human potential-wise, you're right.
That's right. But I think that's the thing is that it's ridiculous. And I think that in terms of being able to move forward, we need to destroy the idea of race and realize that we're one species, you know. And that's what books like Guns, Germs, and Steel and 1493 really enable us to do.
Yeah, that's why, you know, that's why asking the right questions and wrestling mm-hmm. with these questions and reading people that have spent a whole lot more time than you have on these subjects and make a very cogent argument for them. That's why it's important to read the books, man.
That's right. And there was a really great commencement speech that was given, and I think it was at West Point. And the guy said, you know, it was all about the importance of reading. And he said, sure, read magazines and newspaper, but mostly you should read books. And the reason why is because books are distilled thought. You know, if you read an article, it's,
man.
You know, an article is a few hours of thought that have been distilled. A book is years,
10 years
of thought.
A lifetime.
Yeah, exactly. A lifetime. You're taking a lifetime's worth of thinking and concentrating in a couple of hundred pages.
100%, man.
Yeah.
With that thought, ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for being with Brian Callen, Hunter Motz on the Brian Callen
Show. Yeah, let's just be clear. No.
Yeah, I like that I do that. Yeah, exactly. Thank you for being Brian Callen, Hunter Motz on the Brian Callen Show. You son of a bitch.
Callen.
Later.
You've been listening to the Brian Callen Show. Be sure to visit briancallen.com for information about this episode as well as past and future episodes. You can follow Brian on Twitter at Brian Callen and like him on Facebook. Go to facebook.com/Brian Callen Comedy. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you next time.